Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
And now, from the University of Chicago Institute of Politics, The Axe Files, with your host, David Axelrod.
Jorge Ramos is a unique figure in American media today. He came here as an immigrant from Mexico in the early 80s. By the mid-80s, he was an anchorman for Univision, and over the next decades became a singular force. Now, at the age of 57, he splits his time between Univision and Fusion, a new network that's aimed at millennials. And it's clear that he's become quite a force among millennials because he came to the Institute of Politics the other night and sold out an auditorium in a matter of minutes and electrified the audience. We also had a great conversation right here. Jorge Ramos, the Walter Cronkite of Hispanic media. How are you sick of hearing that? That seems like almost a cliche by now. In fact, I heard they're starting to call Walter Cronkite the Jorge Ramos of Anglo media.
Well, I'm 57, so I'm feeling the age. And, you know, next year is going to be my 30th year as an anchorman for Univision in News in Spanish. I started when I was 28. And I never expected that I was going to be that long doing exactly the same thing. I at one point remember the salarymen in Japan that they used to work in the same company for all their lives. I'm feeling exactly the same way. Since I started working in the United States, it's been with Univision. Now I'm working also with Fusion, which is an ABC and Univision partnership. But at the end, what I'm happy is that people still believe what I say. They still trust you. And if you're a journalist and people don't believe what you say, it really doesn't matter. And what's also funny is that every 4 years, they remember us. In other words, they remember that the Latino community exists simply because they need the Hispanic vote. I call it the Christopher Columbus syndrome. Every 4 years, they rediscover us, and then they forget about us. So it is one of those years. So I'm happy just to be here.
Your career began back in Mexico City, where you were raised. I want to talk a little bit about that, because I want to talk about how Jorge Ramos becomes Jorge Ramos. Talk a little bit about your upbringing, and then I want to talk about how you wound up here and the break you had with your first television station, because that's such an interesting story.
I grew up in Mexico City. I have three brothers and a sister. And the time in which I was growing up in Mexico, it was kind of difficult. My father was very authoritarian. And you either would agree with him or you would have to leave the house. I remember that when I decided to study journalism and communication, he told me that was not a legitimate profession. He wanted me to be a doctor, an attorney, an engineer, or an architect like him. Those were the only professions that were legitimate for him. And then when I told him, no, I want to study communications. I want to study journalism. I remember clearly that he said, what are you going to do with that? And that expression stayed with me for a long time. I told that, you know, I don't know exactly what I'm going to do with that, but that's precisely what I want to do.
Why did you want to do it?
I realized that journalism was my way of being a witness to what was happening in the world. I wanted to travel. And that was the only way to get to know the people that was changing the world. And at some point in my life, I also wanted to get involved in politics. So I thought that journalism was the best way to do that. And
you know, we have this in common. That was my route into politics was I was a journalist. I was a political writer for the Chicago Tribune, and I got into journalism because I was interested in politics. I mean, that was the route into journalism.
So you went from journalism to politics?
Yes.
I thought I was going to go from politics to journalism. At one point, remember, this is 1980s in Mexico. Back then, the same political party had been in power for more than 5 decades. I thought that I was going to die with a PRI, that's the name of the party,
yes,
in power. And I was rebelling against that. So I thought, if I get in politics, it would be impossible for me to do anything in Mexico because you would have to be part of that party, and I didn't want to be part of the PRI. It was a corrupt party. They were responsible for a massacre in 1968 in which hundreds of students had been killed by the army. So I just didn't want to be part of that. So I thought that journalism was an alternative. But then, of course, there was direct censorship from the presidency, from Los Pinos, which is the equivalent of the White House, directly to the mass media. And my third report on the air as a television reporter, I was very young. I was
24 years old.
Exactly. I was completely censored. And they told me, I still remember my boss telling me, you know,
how did that manifest itself? What was the story and what did they stop you from doing?
It was something very simple. I tried to do a story on how the president, in turn, would choose the one who's going to be the next president. Because democracy didn't exist back then. The president would decide who was going to be the next president, and that was about it. And I wanted to talk about it. So I chose to interview two great writers back then. And my boss told me they are not from the house, what he meant is that you couldn't interview people that were not pre-approved by the government. So anyway, I did my story. It was completely censored. I was very young.
So you talked to the people you wanted to talk to.
I did. I did the story exactly the way I wanted to do it. But when I came back to the station, they told me, no, you simply cannot do it. They rewrote the story. They wanted me to track the audio. I said no. And then I wrote my letter of resignation because I knew that I had no future.
So let me ask you this. You're 24 years old. It's tough to get a job in journalism at 24. What is it about you that caused you to be so defiant? What you mentioned your dad was an authoritarian figure. Was it a general resistance to authoritarianism? Or
I think so. I was resisting against the authoritarian ways of my father. I was resisting and rebelling against the authoritarian ways of the church. When I was growing up in elementary school and in high school, the priests that were in charge of the school, they would hit us with shoe soles. And there would be almost physical punishment against the students. So I was rebelling against my father, against the church, and against the government. So obviously, at that point, I decided I can't stay in Mexico. I can't stay. I gotta go. I sold my car. I got $2,000 for my car. UCLA Extension accepted me for a one-year course in journalism and television, and I left everything. January 2nd, 1983. And I remember that feeling of freedom for the first time in my life. Everything that I own, everything, a bag, a guitar, some papers, everything I could carry with my both hands. I never felt more freedom than in those days when I arrived in Los Angeles.
And how were you received in Los Angeles as an immigrant?
I couldn't even understand myself in English. Even now I have a very strong accent. But even just imagine back then, I had studied English for a few years when I was growing up, and it was very difficult. But UCLA Extension helped me a lot. I studied English my first few months, and then I ended up studying journalism and television in the United States. It was difficult because Alexis de Tocqueville says that the rich and the powerful don't go into exile. And he's absolutely right, because I didn't want to be an immigrant. I was forced to be an immigrant because the country where I was born couldn't give me the opportunities that the United States gave me. So that's why I came. And then just imagine, after 1 year at UCLA, I got my job at the Univision station in Los Angeles. And then I realized in those first few weeks that I could say everything. It was an incredible sense of freedom and happiness, because all my life I had been used to censorship and the imposing views of the party in power. And then suddenly here I'm in the United States enjoying the First Amendment, saying whatever I wanted, and nobody ever said anything to me about what I could say and what I couldn't say.
Yeah, I think that's underappreciated.
It is.
If you spend your life in this country and you don't have the experience that you had, you take for those things for granted.
And then, for instance, I've had the opportunity to talk to every single U.S. president since George Bush Sr. And in some cases, I've had confrontations with the U.S. president, with George W. Bush, with President Barack Obama. And it is incredible to be able to criticize the president of the United States. And after that, nothing happens. You're fine. You go home. Nothing happens. And I'm thinking that in Mexico...
Probably not bad for your ratings.
Well, who knows? But just imagine, had I done the same thing in Mexico, let me give you a number. In the last 10 years, 80 journalists have been killed in Mexico for many different reasons. So this is the big difference. Had I stayed in Mexico, maybe for sure I would have been a censored journalist. And who knows if I would have been alive. And then here in the United States, I can report on whatever I want. I can be critical with the system and with the president, and nothing happens. And that's the beauty of this country. It is fantastic.
One of the things that I think make great journalists is great journalists are iconoclasts. Great journalists are willing to challenge authority. That was one of the things that attracted me to being a reporter. And I grew up in a newsroom where you were encouraged to challenge authority. Do you think that that is still the governing dynamic in journalism today? Do you think people are encouraged to challenge authority?
The best examples of journalism that we have, Edward R. Murrow confronting Joe McCarthy, or Walter Cronkite criticizing the Vietnam War, the reporters of the Washington Post forcing the resignation of Richard Nixon, or even Anderson Cooper after Hurricane Katrina criticizing the response of the Bush administration, the horrible response after Hurricane Katrina. Those are examples of journalists challenging power. My concern is that many times in this country we see examples of journalists who are not challenging power. When the president is your friend, when the senator is your friend, when the mayor is your friend, or the candidate is your friend, it is very difficult for you to challenge power. But I think our place as journalists is not within the circle of power, but right on the edge of power. In other words, we have to be in between the White House and the street. We have to be in between the candidates and the voters. And our place as journalists is not only outside the power, but I think our role is to be the anti-power. Our power becomes that possibility of challenging those who are in power. And I'm not seeing that as much as I would like to.
Let me ask you about that, because you know, there is a well-developed image of sort of the anchor man or anchor woman in American television. And yes, there's an element of challenge involved, but it's often about reading the news and presenting the news in a way that people feel comfortable with you. And so the question is, how much is it appropriate to challenge? You've created quite a stir. For example, you created one recently with Donald Trump, and you went and you challenged him at a press conference. There were a lot of folks there who felt that you went there to create a confrontation. I mean, is that a fair surmise?
Exactly, yes, because I felt that there was the need. I had a need as a journalist to confront somebody who was lying and who was wrong about immigrants in this country. I think that the most important social responsibility that we have as journalists is to confront those who are in power. Our role, our real role socially, is to prevent the abuse of those who are in power. And then here comes the question, when is it correct or appropriate to challenge power. Well, I think when it is racism, discrimination, corruption, public lies, dictatorships, and human rights, in those instances, our role is not only appropriate to challenge power, but we are forced. It is our obligation to challenge power when that happens. So when Donald Trump says that some Mexican immigrants are criminals, drug traffickers, and rapists, we know that is not true. All the studies that I've seen, the American Immigration Council, the Migration Policy Center, all of them say that immigrants are less likely to be criminals. Those are the facts. And here comes one candidate who, with his speeches, is promoting bigotry and division and intolerance. That's precisely our role, to challenge them. So I did what every
other... Because there'd be those who would argue that, no, your role is to deliver the news and tell people what happened that day.
That's just part of my role. I think I have to be right. If five people died, I have to say five. If it's red, I have to say red. I have to be accurate and I have to be precise. But that's just part of our role as journalists. The other part of our role, and that's very important, and sometimes we forget that we have that responsibility, is to challenge those who are in power and to take a stand. I know this is debatable, but I think we have to take a stand when it comes, again, to racism, discrimination, corruption, public lies, dictatorship, and human rights. If we don't take a stand, we are not doing our job. And that's precisely what I did with Donald Trump. I started in a nice way. So after he said that, I said, I need to talk to Donald Trump. So I sent him a letter. Instead of responding to my letter and saying, yes or no, I want to give you the interview, he published on the internet my cell phone. And of course, I had to change my cell phone number.
So you should have tweeted. That's how he likes to communicate.
Well, but he didn't even do that. So he put it. He put my cell phone number on the internet. So the first lesson with Donald Trump is that should never, ever, ever give him your cell phone number. After that, that was in June, we were thinking of ways of challenging him, of finding the right moment to confront him. And we found in last August the possibility of doing that in Iowa. So we went to Iowa to talk to him. And after I started asking my questions, he immediately realized who I was. And then he did exactly what he's been doing for the past few months, which is try to silence me and call on another reporter. But we had seen that in the press conferences before. We had studied what he had done. So I made two choices. First, that I was going to ask my question standing up. Visually, it is very important for TV to be standing up. Had I stayed sitting down, it would have been an imbalance. And second, that he all the time tries to interrupt you, saying, excuse me, excuse me, excuse me. And I was going to continue asking my question regardless of whatever he was going to be saying. And that's what I did. And he couldn't handle that. And then he did the impossible, which I thought that was impossible that I would ever see something like that in the United States, which is a direct attack on freedom of the press. He called his bodyguard to throw me out of a press conference. In my 30 years as journalist, I have never been ejected from a press conference. I've been to Cuba and to Venezuela, but I've had never been ejected by a bodyguard from a press conference. The only bodyguard who had stopped me from asking questions in the past was Fidel Castro's bodyguard in 1990 in Mexico, in Guadalajara, Mexico. That was the only example that I have in which I had faced something like that. And then here comes Donald Trump doing exactly the same in the United States.
But that was pretty good television, right?
It was good television. Part of the television has two elements. One has to do with content, and another part has to do with performance. So in that sense, it's not that I did good television. Television doesn't happen like that. You have to produce television. But it was Donald Trump who made a huge mistake. I think by asking a bodyguard to throw me out of a press conference, he made a huge mistake. You know, he doesn't like to apologize, but he made a mistake. And then while I was outside of the press conference, two great reporters, one from MSNBC and Tom Llamas from ABC News, Casey Hunt from MSNBC, they forced Donald Trump to change his decision. And they told him that if President Barack Obama had been able to withstand my questions, why wasn't he able to do exactly the same? And Casey Hunt did a beautiful thing. She said, you know, it's my turn, but let Ramos ask the question for me. And Donald Trump was forced to change his decision. And the same bodyguard that had thrown me out of the press conference was forced to open the door for me. And I came back and asked my questions.
Why do you think Trump has found such an audience for his message? You talk about how inaccurate it is, how unfair it is, how distasteful it is, and yet he's found an audience with it. What is it that is resonating out there about that message, and how much does that concern you?
Whenever there's a problem in the United States and in many other countries, instinctively, many people blame immigrants for that. It doesn't matter if it has to do with the economy or with crime. Whenever there are problems in this country, they tend to blame immigrants. I'm so used to that when Donald Trump criticized Mexican immigrants, I thought that there was going to be no response. But something has changed. What has changed is that the Hispanic community has grown enormously. We are 55 million right now. In 35 years, there's going to be more than 100 million Latinos in this country. So for the first time in our life, we have gone from big numbers to power. In other words, for the first time, we are responding with power. And therefore, Univision and NBC and other companies decided to break their partnerships with Donald Trump. So why is it resonating? Unfortunately, the reason is very simple, which is there are millions of people who think just like Donald Trump. That's the truth. The best about the United States is its opportunities, but the worst still is discrimination and racism.
And where do you think this Republican debate is going? Are you fearful that Trump will be the nominee on the basis of those positions?
I take Donald Trump very seriously. I think we make a mistake if we don't take him seriously. Even though he's having problems in Iowa and nationwide, Ben Carson now is number one. I take Donald Trump very seriously because it is very dangerous when a candidate promotes bigotry and discrimination through his speeches and using his position to promote bigotry. I think it is incredibly dangerous. So I take him very seriously. Of course, he could be the nominee.
How do you square that, Jorge, though, with the fact that the other candidates who are most frequently mentioned in the conversation, at least right now, because this is a very dynamic process. I know this from my own experience, but Ben Carson, an African-American, Marco Rubio, a Cuban-American, Ted Cruz, a Cuban-American, they're the names that you hear most often when people are talking these days. So it seems like a strange paradox that you have this nativism coming from Trump, mm-hmm. and you have now these other candidates in some ways are mirroring his message on some of this stuff. But how do you account for that?
First, again, I think the reason is very simple. Millions of Americans agree with Donald Trump. And unfortunately, what I'm seeing in the Republican Party is that even though for the first time in history, we have two Latinos running for the White House, Marco Rubio and Ted Cruz, those Latinos, Marco Rubio and Ted Cruz, had decided not to defend undocumented immigrants. And this breaks a long tradition of important Latino figures that have taken in their own hands the responsibility of defending undocumented immigrants. But then Marco Rubio...
He was part of a group that was involved for a while in a group that was trying to solve the immigration
issue. He changed his position. I still can't believe how come Marco Rubio, who's the son of immigrants, both his parents were born in Cuba, or Ted Cruz, whose father, Rafael Cruz, was born in Cuba, how come they are not defending other immigrants like their parents? I really can't understand that. I think it is very important to have two Latinos running for the White House. And And I think the Democratic Party has a problem.
Because I want to ask you about that. My own party, I've spoken about this. We're supposed to be the party of diversity, but at the top of our party, where are the Hispanic candidates?
Are they? Exactly.
We have an African-American president, but if you look at the Senate and you look at the governorships, Republican Party has actually done better than the Democratic Party. Why do you think that is?
Well, it is very clear that the Republican Party has been preparing candidates. And I haven't seen that in the Democratic Party.
I agree with
you.
That's exactly it.
Exactly. And they for many years, they've been preparing not only Marco Rubio and Ted Cruz, but many other candidates in different positions. I haven't seen that in the Democratic Party. When I ask Democrats what's the problem with diversity within the Democratic Party, they say, well, look at the White House. We have President Barack Obama. And I'm saying, you know, that's so 2008. No, it's all right. He changed history. He's changing history, but it is not enough. And there's a problem. As you know, and this has been said many, many times, Ronald Reagan used to say that Latinos are really Republicans. They just don't know it. When it comes to certain values, when it comes to abortion, when it comes to religion, when it comes to the importance of family, maybe Latinos might feel more comfortable with Republican values than with Democratic values. But Republicans haven't been able to exploit that. In the last two elections, you know what happened. John McCain got 31% of the Hispanic vote. That was not enough. Mitt Romney got 27%. It was not enough. And the last poll that I've seen with AP, Donald Trump has 11% of the Hispanic vote. That's clearly not enough.
What if a Rubio, a Cruz or a Jeb Bush, they're different. They're all different. But let's take Rubio and Bush who are Spanish speaking, and would they change the dynamic if they were the nominees of the Republican
Party? It is quite possible, because I know that people have been using 40 or 45% of the Hispanic vote needed for the Republicans to win, but I wouldn't go that far. I just want to, just by studying what had happened in the last two elections, if they can reach 33%, about 33%, it's not a set number, but about 33%, the Republican candidate could win.
Yeah, I think it may be more, but George W. Bush got 44% of the Hispanic vote in 2004, and that was the last Republican to win.
Exactly, that was 44%. But every Republican candidate who gets above 33% has won an election. So even though it might be a higher number, clearly 31%, John McCain, or 27%, Mitt Romney, or 11%, Donald Trump, is not enough. So when Donald Trump says, I'm going to win the Hispanic vote, he's absolutely wrong. It is impossible.
Are there other people, in addition to Bush and Rubio, who you think could reach into the Hispanic community in a serious way on the Republican side?
The only way for Latinos to take a serious look at Republicans is if they can put away the immigration issue. And they are not willing to do that. It is because immigration is personal to us. You know, and I know, that the most important issues for Latinos
are not immigration.
Exactly. It's the economy, education, healthcare, jobs. Those are more important than immigration. But immigration is emotionally so important to us. It is personal because half of all Latinos above 18 years of age are, just like me, immigrants. We're foreigners. So when you're attacking other immigrants, you're attacking me.
Well, one of the interesting things that happened in the last election was that Mitt Romney also only got 25% of the Asian vote because Asians felt attacked by this anti-immigrant sentiment. And it drove Asians, who were a more fluid group, into the Democratic column. So this is widely felt. Let me ask you, though, you know, people sort of lump these folks together, Bush, Rubio. Something that interests me, when I was doing television advertising here in the city of Chicago and elsewhere, where there were diverse Hispanic, we talk about the Hispanic community, but there are many Hispanic communities. Here, there's a very strong Mexican-American community. There's a strong Puerto Rican community. Mm-hmm. And traditionally, they have not been very close. And so when I did ads, I would hire a Colombian voiceover because I didn't want to offend either the Mexican Americans or Puerto Ricans. And I know that I don't know if this is so, that your accent when you're broadcasting is not a Mexican accent.
You're right.
And I presume you're making that same judgment that you have to appeal to a broader audience. Is that?
That's absolutely right. My accent is completely neutral. My first news director here in the United States showed me how to have a neutral accent in Spanish, and that is simply by not extending the vowels. So instead of saying presidente, you just say presidente. In other words, and if you do that in Spanish, then you have a neutral accent. And many people didn't have an idea if I was from Mexico or from Colombia or from Cuba, which is great, especially in a community which is so diverse.
The reason I ask you that is there's this presumption that Rubio would do very, very well among Hispanic vote writ large. When we were doing research on potential vice presidential nominees who Mitt Romney might choose, there was an interesting thing that we found, which was that that Mexican Americans were not terribly receptive to Rubio as a Cuban American. They didn't feel a kinship with him. Do you think that would be a barrier for him if he ran, if he were the nominee?
Yes, absolutely. Because, as you know, Cuban Americans tend to vote more for the Republican Party than for the Democratic Party. But I don't think that neither Rubio nor Bush nor Cruz could win the majority of the Hispanic vote. That would be impossible because the tradition is very strong. I think Democrats will win the Hispanic vote, no question about it. But it doesn't matter because the only thing they need is to go above 33%. And that's something that Rubio and Bush can do. And that's a big threat for the Democratic Party because both Rubio and George Bush and Ted Cruz, if he does better, they can get above 33%. Just imagine Jeb Bush speaking Spanish directly to Latinos. Just imagine Marco
Rubio.
Now,
he does speak with a Mexican accent.
With a Mexican accent, but you can clearly understand Jeb Bush. And obviously, in the case of Marco Rubio, just imagine those two candidates speaking directly to the Latinos. We have an example, and you know that George W. Bush was the first U.S. president who thought that he spoke Spanish. And he was wrong. However, he made a huge effort to try to communicate in Spanish. And he was just saying a few words in Spanish. Hola, buenas noches, bienvenidos, welcome. And that worked, David. Because, you know, he got 44% of the Hispanic vote at the end. Of course, he also suggested that he was going to legalize the majority of undocumented immigrants. And he was already talking with President Vicente Fox to have an immigration agreement between both countries. And obviously after 9/11, nothing happened.
You know, I was in the White House for a couple of years when in the first couple of years of the Obama administration. You were very tough on the president and in his reelection because we didn't enact comprehensive immigration reform. I was in a room in the summer of 2009 when the president met with everyone, Democrat and Republican, who had supported immigration reform under George W. Bush. And we couldn't get any of the Republicans to join with us in a joint effort to pass it. Why did you feel that the onus was on the president? You're a student of American democracy. We've learned in great painful detail that Congress has the ability to block a lot of things. So why were you, you know, and I'm not here to prosecute a grievance. I'm just eager to know why you made that distinction.
And I'm glad you're bringing this up because that's also, I'm so curious about what happened. I've asked everyone about what happened in those days.
Let's resolve that right now.
I even spoke with Ben Bernanke a few days ago and asked him what happened. First, is that candidate?
We never should have put Bernanke in charge of immigration reform. That was our first mistake, right there.
The first problem, if you want to put it that way, is that a candidate Barack Obama promised in Denver, Colorado, that he was going to introduce immigration reform during his first year in office. Let's put it in context. Back then, candidate Hillary Clinton had promised to introduce immigration reform during the first 100 days. So candidate Obama thought that in order to win the Hispanic vote, he needed to promise something similar. And he told me, not in the first 100 days, but in the first year. So that was the promise. And among Latinos, that was known as La Promesa de Obama, Obama's promise. Then President Obama makes history. He gets to the White House. And then nothing happens. I know that we were in the middle of an economic crisis. But he knew that even before he was president. So why did he promise something like that? And then when both chambers of Congress were in Democratic hands, why he didn't use those moments, those few months before Kennedy passed away? Why he didn't use those moments to pass immigration reform?
Is it your assumption that all those Democrats were in favor of comprehensive immigration reform?
I wouldn't say all of them, but...
But we only had, at our peak, 60 Democrats, which is the minimum you needed to override a filibuster.
So. Yeah, but that was even before healthcare reform. So my question is, when you had the White House in both chambers of Congress, why didn't you use those moments, that time, to try to introduce immigration reform?
Well,
why not in the first 100 days?
The answer is we couldn't pass it. We didn't have the votes to pass it. If we had had the votes to pass it, he would have moved forward on it. And in some ways, you're at the mercy of the legislative leadership as well. Their message was, hey, we've got all this economic stuff that you just moved that was hard. You're trying to pass comprehensive health reform, which, as you know, had disproportionate impact on the Hispanic community as well. And there's a limit to what the load can carry, so this is going to have to wait. And so it was. There's no doubt it was a political decision about what could be accomplished. We tried to pass at the end of the first 2 years the Dream Act, and we got 55 votes in the Senate. For the Dream Act, which was short of what we wanted in terms of comprehensive
reform. That's what I'm saying. It was a political decision.
Decision in the sense that we couldn't accomplish it in that time frame. So you have to make choices.
But exactly. And then somebody decided in the White House, and that's why I'm curious how it happened. Somebody decided that let's sacrifice the Hispanic community. This is the promise.
But Jorge, is it a sacrifice? Would the Hispanic community have been advantaged by trying and losing?
I mean, of course not. Of course not.
Okay.
Yeah. No.
So that's. I mean, that was the choice. Because the choice was what? Do we want to go for this? Force people to take what in some of their constituents would be a hard vote and not be able to pass it because that was the choice.
Because my impression, and this is new for me, because my impression was that there were the votes.
Oh no!
That in both houses that the votes were there to pass immigration reform.
No, that's not right. I guarantee you, if the votes were there, that the president would have moved it.
That's precisely where we've had a conflict with the president, because we've always been under the impression that when he was controlling both chambers, that he could have moved on immigration, and he decided not to. And that's...
Well, there's no doubt he decided not to, but the votes were not there. If the votes were there, he would have moved
correctly.
It.
He didn't explain it correctly because we only know that he decided not to move on immigration. And then after that, he started deporting hundreds of thousands of immigrants. He has deported more immigrants than any other president in the history of the United States. So here we have a president who had promised something. For us, he didn't keep his word. He didn't explain correctly why he couldn't move on immigration. And then he has deported and destroyed millions, thousands of families. So, and moved too late on the Dreamers and obviously with the parents of the Dreamers. Too late.
And how do you assess him now? He's obviously taken actions over the years. Do you think that he's been... a positive force or not?
I certainly appreciate the fact that he still fights for immigration reform, that he's always trying to do something about it. However, I think that within the Hispanic community, three major failings are always reported. First, his promise. Second, that he didn't move on immigration. Third, that he's deported a lot of people. And then finally, that he moved too late, way too late. Why in the 6 year he moved on? When he realized that nothing was going to be done with immigration reform, why didn't he move before? He changed his position, as you know. Well, I don't know if you know, but he said that he didn't have the authority to enact the Dream Act or DACA. And he did have the authority.
Yeah. Although I think his concern, and I'm not here to debate you on his behalf. He can do that on his own. But his concern, and it remains his concern, that actions that are taken solely on executive authority are actions that can easily be reversed by future presidents, and that the long-term solution is a legislative solution. So let me ask you this: what's your assessment of the chances in the next few years of actually enacting comprehensive immigration reform?
You know, I think we were very close in 2013, very, very close after the Senate passed immigration reform. And now I'm sensing that it's becoming more and more difficult.
Paul Ryan just got elected Speaker of the House.
Nominated.
Nominated, but he'll be named, but one presumes, Speaker of the House. There was some dissent in the part of the reason there was dissent in the Republican caucus was because he's been an outspoken supporter of immigration reform. He's done events with Luis Gutierrez and others.
And he made a commitment not to bring immigration reform to a vote until President Obama leaves office.
And do you think ultimately he'll be an ally on this?
I hope so. I certainly hope so. I hope that he doesn't flip-flop on immigration, because he's really our last chance. And we got to see who wins the White House. If it's Democrats, probably the Senate would support that, but we would need Paul Ryan, no question about it. And then if nothing happens, you know, I've been taken by surprise by the strength of Donald Trump's ideas on immigration and how many Americans are supporting that point of view. And if that continues, that means that we won't have immigration reform, and that we will have a generation that will have to sacrifice themselves for those who are coming now.
I think it's important to point out that in most of the polling that I've seen, even a majority of Republicans are in favor of some positive resolution to this that would legalize the status of the undocumented workers. So it isn't as if Trump's representing a majority of Americans or anything closer, or even a majority of Republicans, but it's a very strident group within the Republican Party that seems to jam up the works.
But the problem for the Republicans is if they don't understand that immigration reform or some kind of immigration law is a prerequisite for Latinos to take a serious look at them, they're going to continue losing the White House over and over and over again.
I think there are a lot of Republicans who know that and agree with you. They're frustrated and having, and they haven't really unified behind.
They're going to lose the White House
in the race.
They're going to lose the White House again. Next year, there are going to be 26 million Latinos eligible to vote. Obviously, not all of them are going to go to the polls, but let's say that 15 million or 16 million will go to the polls. More than enough to decide a close election. President Obama in the last election, he won by less than 5 million votes. Mm-hmm. So 60 million Latinos could decide the next election. And Republicans, if they don't understand that, they're going
to
lose.
Well, more to the point, there are states like Colorado, Florida, and others that can be tipped by Latino votes.
Exactly. And every month, thousands of Latinos are turning 18. And this is what I call the Latino wave. And this Latino wave will continue. And the fact is that The new rule in politics for us is that no one obviously can make it to the White House without the Hispanic vote. But this will continue. We'll be more than 100 million Latinos in less than 35 years. And what Donald Trump doesn't understand, he doesn't understand the new America, because then in 2055, and you'll be 100, I'll be 97,
yeah.
And hopefully we'll be here,
yes.
Right?
Yes.
All right.
We'll still be having a conversation, I hope.
We'll have a conversation. Yeah. In 2055, the white population in this country will become a minority.
Yes.
So the big trend in this country, other than technology, the big trend is that this country is becoming more multicultural, multi-ethnic, multiracial. That's the trend. Donald Trump doesn't believe that. He thinks that he can win the White House only with a white vote. He's completely wrong. So if you don't see this trend in which everyone is going to be a minority, then you don't understand the United States. And Republicans, many Republicans, cannot see that and cannot understand that that's precisely what's happening right now.
I got to cover three things with you before I
sure.
let you go. One is Mexico and its own leadership crisis. You had a new president elected, Peña Nieto, 3 years ago.
Yeah.
And there was great hope, and he started off with a wave of reforms. He seems to be bogged down now with a ton of problems. What happened to him, and have you lost hope for him?
Absolutely. I have no hope in Peña Nieto. He's repeating the same practices of the PRI, the same PRI that I knew when I was growing up in Mexico. Two major problems. One has to do with corruption. Can you imagine if in the United States, the First Lady would buy a house from a government contractor and she would make a contract for $7 million? The president would have to leave office. Well, that's precisely what happened in Mexico. The Mexican First Lady, Angelica Rivera, he bought a house for $7 million from a government contractor who's getting millions of dollars from Peña Nieto's government, and nothing happened. Absolutely nothing happened. So that's in terms of corruption. So if the president of Mexico cannot control what's going on within his own home, just imagine with the rest of the country. Then there are a lot of human rights violations. Last year, in a little town in southern Mexico called Ayotzinapa, 43 students disappeared. Most likely they were killed. And even now, the president doesn't know where they are. Most likely the federal police and the Mexican army had a role in the disappearance of those.
Because they were dissidents.
Exactly. They were protesting the government. Mm-hmm. And
goes to your point earlier.
Exactly. So just imagine that human rights are being violated constantly in Mexico. And finally, there seems to be no rule of law. El Chapo, the most important drug trafficker in the world, suddenly escaped.
Biggest drug supplier to the city of Chicago, by the way. We have a big interest in that story.
Here. Well, just imagine, how is it possible that the most important drug trafficker in the world suddenly escapes from a maximum security prison?
Seems odd, I got to confess.
In a tunnel.
Yeah.
So if you put together corruption, crime, he's a very weak president. Peña Nieto is an incredibly weak president who in the most important moments disappears. Instead of talking, you know that he hasn't given a single press conference since he became president? Can you imagine President Obama doing something like that? It is unthinkable.
It is one thing to challenge political
sure.
leaders. You've also challenged the church
yeah.
on many occasions.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, you grew up in a Catholic environment. What do you think of this new pope? Have you had a chance to meet him?
No, it would have been great. But I had a problem with a cardinal once, with a Mexican cardinal, who made sure that I couldn't have access to Pope Francis. But I love this pope. I think Pope Francis is fantastic. And I love what he did here in the United States, talking about climate change and talking about politics and talking about immigration. I'm very disillusioned with what he did in Cuba because he didn't want to confront dictators Raul Castro and Fidel Castro. But I am concerned with that the changes that we're seeing with Pope Francis are more in style than in substance. Mainly when it comes to the cases of sexual abuse. He has a zero tolerance policy. However, he has done absolutely nothing with the bishops and the cardinals who knew about what was happening, and they are still in their posts. So in that sense, and in the...
Do you think the changes he will bring to the church will be lasting changes?
I think it's only in style. He doesn't have the interest or the will to bring in women to the church to become priests.
But in fairness, how much can he do? I mean, he seems to be challenging a lot of the orthodoxy of the church in terms of attitudes about a number of these issues and reorienting the church to fighting for the poor, the disadvantaged. And there's a lot of change that he's promoting at a very fast clip. But you don't think in substance?
Not in substance.
Not even on those things?
Not in substance.
And the climate change stuff.
Exactly, because just imagine, even though he has a very positive attitude towards gays, I mean, who am I to judge, he said in a plane once. Gays are still banned from getting married in the church. And sometimes they cannot even go to church in certain countries. And women are not allowed to be at the same level as men. And the cases of sexual abuse within the church are being analyzed and studied within the church. But priests and bishops and cardinals who knew about what was happening are still in their position. So it's only style, not substance.
Talk to me for just a minute about your new project, Fusion. It's led by a board member of the Institute of Politics. We're proud to claim him as such, Isaac Lee, brilliant guy. What are you trying to accomplish there? This is a new project that really speaks to the changing nature of our demographics in this country.
Exactly. The idea, by the way, today, it's our second anniversary on the air.
And the fact that we had cake.
Yes, we had in Miami. The fact that we're standing, that we're thriving, means that the project was conceived correctly. At the beginning, we thought that we only wanted to aim at young Latinos. And then we did some research, and we realized we were going to make a huge mistake because young Latinos didn't want to be put in a special box. And they realized that that instead of just aiming at young Latinos, we were going to aim at millennials overall, and it's working. What's really interesting about Fusion, for instance, I'm doing a show in which half the audience that I have don't own a TV. So I'm doing television for people who don't have a television, and that's the new challenge for us as journalists. And if we don't understand that this is changing so fast, we're going to lose our jobs.
So they ran out and got the Walter Cronkite of Hispanic to relate to these millennials, and it's working. That says a lot about you.
Well, I mean, I think if you are a true journalist, you always have to be a rebel. And I think that's what millennials want to do all the time. They want to be rebels. And they are being rebels because they're revolutionizing whatever we do. And I'm learning a lot from them.
Well, Jorge, it's good to have you here. We learn a lot from you all the time, and I appreciate you spending time with us.
This is wonderful. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to The Axe Files. For more podcasts like this, subscribe to The Axe Files on iTunes. And for more programming from the University of Chicago Institute of Politics, visit politics.uchicago.edu.
Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.